Chapter 17. The Endymion Heights. The event itself was unprecedented. Not since the fall of Cannae to the Skilvendi hordes had so many potentates gathered in one place. But few knew mankind itself lay upon the balance. And who could guess that a brief exchange of glances, not the Shrya's edict, would tip that balance? But is this not the very enigma of history? When one peers deep enough, one always finds that catastrophe and triumph, the proper objects of the historian's scrutiny, inevitably turn upon the small, the trivial, the nightmarishly accidental. When I reflect overmuch on this fact, I do not fear that we are drunks at the sacred dance, as Protathus writes, but that there is no dance at all. Drusus Acamian, Compendium of the First Holy War. Late Spring, 4111, Year of the Tusk, Momum. With Naor, Zynemus, and the 5 Conryan Palatines who had taken up the Tusk, Kellus followed Nersae Proias through the galleries of the Endymion Heights. One of the Emperor's eunuchs led them, trailing the oily scent of musk and balsam. Turning from a discussion with Zynemus, Proias summoned Naor to his side. Kellus had closely mapped the capricious swings of Proias's humor over the course of their journey to the imperial precincts. The man had been elated and anxious by turns. Now he was clearly elated. The thought nearly leapt from the man's profile. This will work. Though it galls the rest of us, Proias said, trying to sound offhand. In many ways, the Nansur are the most ancient people of the Three Seas, descendants of the Canaans of near antiquity and the Kyrenians of far antiquity. They live their lives in the shadow of monumental works, and so feel compelled to erect monuments. He opened his hands to the soaring marmoreal vaults, such as this. He explains away the strength of his enemy's house, Kellus realized. He fears this place may overawe the Skilvendi. Naor grimaced and spat on the gloomy pastorals passing beneath their feet. Over a fat shoulder, the eunuch glared at him, then nervously quickened his pace. Proias glanced at the Skilvendi, his disapproving eyes belied by a smirk. Ordinarily, Naor, I would not presume to amend your manners, but things may go better for us if you avoid spitting. At this, one of the more hard-humored palatines, Lord Ingaiaban, laughed aloud. The Skilvendi squared his jaw but said nothing otherwise. A week had passed since they had joined the Holy War and secured the hospitality of Nersae Proias. In that time, Kellus had spent long hours in the probability trance, assessing, extrapolating, and reassessing this extraordinary twist of circumstance. But the Holy War had proven incalculable. Nothing he'd thus far encountered could compare with the sheer number of variables it presented. Of course, the nameless thousands who constituted its bulk were largely irrelevant, significant only in their sum, but the handful of men who were relevant, who would ultimately determine the Holy War's fate, had remained inaccessible to him. That would change in a matter of moments. The great contest between the Emperor and the great names of the Holy War had come to a head. Offering Naor as a substitute for Icuri Confis, Proias had petitioned Mathenet to settle the dispute of the Emperor's indenture, and Icuri Zarius III had accordingly invited all the great names to plead their case and hear the Shrya's judgment. They were to meet in his privy gardens, sequestered somewhere within the gilded compounds of the Endymion Heights. One way or another, the Holy War was about to march on distant Shima. Whether the Shrya sided with the great names and ordered the Emperor to provision the Holy War, or with the Icuri dynasty and ordered the great names to sign the imperial indenture, meant little to Kellus. Either way, it seemed the leaders of the Holy War would have competent counsel. The brilliance of Icuri Confis, the Nansur exalt general, was grudgingly acknowledged even by Proias, and the intelligence of Naor, as Kellus knew firsthand, was beyond question. What mattered was that the Holy War eventually prevail against the Fainim and bear him to Shima, to his father, his mission. Is this what you wanted, Father? Is this war to be my lesson?
I wonder, Zynemus said wryly, what the Emperor will make of a Skilvendi drinking his wine and pinching his servants' bums.
The prince and his fellow potentates rumbled with laughter.
He'll be too busy snapping his teeth in fury, Proyas replied.
I have little patience for these games, Naor said,
and although the others heard this as a curious admission, Kellis knew it to be a warning. This will be his trial, and I'll be tried through him.
The games, another Palatine, Lord Gaedeki, replied, are about to end, my savage friend.
As always, Naor bristled at their patronizing tone. His nostrils even flared. How much degradation will he bear to see my father dead?
The game is never over, Proyas asserted. The game is without beginning or end.
Without beginning or end. Kellis had been a boy of 11 the first time he heard this phrase. He'd been summoned from his training to a small shrine on the first terrace, where he was to meet Kesriga Jukal. Even though Kellis had already spent years minimizing his passions, the prospect of meeting Jukal frightened him. He was one of the Pragma, the senior brethren of the Dunyane, and meetings between such men and young boys usually resulted in anguish for the latter, the anguish of trial and revelation. Sunlight fell in shafts between the shrine's pillars, making the stone pleasantly warm beneath his small feet. Outside, under the ramparts of the first terrace, the poplars were combed by the mountain wind. Kellis lingered in the light, feeling the bland warmth of the sun soak his gown and bare scalp.
You have drunk your fill as they directed you?
The Pragma asked. He was an old man, his face as empty of expression as the architecture of the shrine was devoid of flourish. One might have thought he stared at a stone rather than a boy, so blank was his expression.
Yes, Pragma.
The Logos is without beginning or end, young Kellis. Do you understand this?
The instruction had begun.
No, Pragma, Kellis replied.
Though he still suffered fear and hope, he had long before overcome his compulsion to misrepresent the extent of his knowledge. A child had little choice when his teachers could see through faces.
Thousands of years ago, when the Dunyane first found—
After the ancient wars?
Kellis eagerly interrupted.
When we were still refugees?
The Pragma struck him, fiercely enough to send him rolling across the hard stone. Kellis scrambled back to position and wiped the blood from his nose. But he felt little fear, and even less regret. The blow was a lesson, nothing more. Among the Dunyane, everything was a lesson. The Pragma regarded him with utter dispassion.
Interruption is weakness, young Kellis. It arises from the passions and not from the intellect, from the darkness that comes before.
I understand, Pragma.
The cold eyes peered through him and saw this was true.
When the Dunyane first found Ishual in these mountains, they knew only one principle of the Logos. What was that principle, young Kellis?
That which comes before determines that which comes after.
The Pragma nodded.
2,000 years have passed, young Kellis, and we still hold that principle true. Does that mean the principle of before and after, of cause and effect, has grown old?
No, Pragma.
And why is that? Do men not grow old and die? Do not even mountains age and crumble with time?
Yes, Pragma.
Then how can this principle not be old?
Because,
Kellis answered, struggling to snuff a flare of pride,
the principle of before and after is nowhere to be found within the circuit of before and after. It is the ground of what is young and what is old, and so cannot itself be young or old.
Yes, the Logos is without beginning or end, and yet man, young Kellis, does possess a beginning and end, like all beasts. Why is man distinct from other beasts?
Because, like beasts, man stands within the circuit of before and after, and yet he apprehends the Logos. He possesses intellect.
Indeed. And why, Kellis, do the Dunyain breed for intellect? Why do we so assiduously train young children such as you in the ways of thought, limb, and face?
Because of the quandary of man.
And what is the quandary of man?
A bee had droned into the shrine, and now it etched drowsy, random circles beneath the vault. That he is a beast, that his appetites arise from the darkness of his soul, that his world assails him with arbitrary circumstance, and yet he apprehends the Logos.
Precisely. And what is the solution to the quandary of man?
To be utterly free of bestial appetite, to utterly command the unfolding of circumstance, to be the perfect instrument of Logos, and so attain the absolute.
Yes, young Kellis. And are you a perfect instrument of Logos?
No, Pragma.
And why is that?
Because I am afflicted by passions. I am my thoughts, but the sources of my thoughts exceed me. I do not own myself, because the darkness comes before me.
Indeed it does, child. What is the name we give to the dark sources of thought?
Legion. We call them the Legion.
The Pragma raised a palsied hand, as though to mark a crucial way station in their pilgrimage.
Yes. You are about to embark, young Kellis, on the most difficult stage of your conditioning, the mastery of the Legion within. Only by doing this will you be able to survive the labyrinth.
This will answer the question of the thousand halls?
No. But it will enable you to ask properly.
Somewhere near the summit of the Andiamine Heights, they passed through an ivory-paneled corridor, then found themselves blinking in the Emperor's privy garden. Between paved lanes, the grass was soft and immaculate, dark beneath the shade of different trees, which formed spokes about a circular pool in the garden's heart, a watery rendition of the imperial sun. Hibiscus, standing lotus, and aromatic shrubs thronged from plots adjacent to the lanes. Kellis glimpsed hummingbirds sorting between blooms in the sunlight. Where the public areas of the imperial precincts had been constructed to overawe guests with dimension and ostentation, the privy garden had been designed, Kellis understood, to foster intimacy, to move visiting dignitaries with the gift of the emperor's confidence. This was a place of simplicity and elegance, the humble heart of the emperor made earth and stone. Gathered beneath cypress and tamarisk trees, the Enrithi lords, Galioth, Tidoni, Einoni, Thonieri, and even some Nansur, stood in clots around what must have been the emperor's bench. Though decked in finery and lacking arms, they looked more like soldiers than courtiers. Pubescent slaves floated among them, their swelling breasts bare and their coltish legs glistening with oils, trays of wine and various delicacies swaying from their hips. Bowls were tipped back in toasts. Greasy fingers were wiped on fine muslins and silks. The lords of the Holy War, all gathered in one place.
The study deepens, Father.
Faces turned and voices fell silent as they approached. Several hailed Proyas, but most stared at Neyur, emboldened by the open scrutiny of numbers. Proyas, Kellis knew, had purposefully prevented any of the great names from meeting Neyur in order to better control this moment. Their expressions attested to the wisdom of his decision. Even dressed as an Enrithi, a white linen tunic under a knee-length gray silk coat, Neyur radiated feral strength. His embattled face, his powerful frame, iron limbs and neck-breaking hands, his swazand, his eyes like cold topaz. Everything about him either spoke of murderous deeds or suggested murderous intent. Most of the Enrithi were impressed. Kellis saw awe, envy, even lust. Here at last was a Skilvendi, and the aspect of the man, it seemed, was more than a match for the rumors they had heard. Neyur weathered their scrutiny with disdain, looking from man to man as though appraising cattle. Proyas murmured several words to Zynemus, then hastened to draw both Neyur and Kellis aside. Suddenly, the lords erupted in solicitations. Zynemus deflected them, crying,
You'll hear what the man has to say soon enough.
Proyas grimaced, muttered, That went as well as could be expected, I suppose. The Conryan prince, Kellis had discovered, was a pious yet quietly tempestuous man. He possessed a strength, a moral certainty that somehow compelled others to seek his sanction, but he was also keen to unearth impieties, dubious of the very men drawn to his certainty. Kellis had found this combination of doubt and certitude perplexing at first, but after his evening with Drusus Acamian, he realized the crown prince had been trained to be suspicious. Proyas was wary out of habit. As with the Skilvendi, Kellis had been forced to move at tangents when dealing with him. Even after several days of discussion and probing questions, the man still harbored reservations.
They seem anxious, Kellis said.
And why not? Proyas replied. I bring them a prince who claims to dream of Shima and a Skilvendi heathen who could be their general.
He glanced pensively at his fellow men of the Tusk.
These men will be your peers, he said. Heed them. Learn them. To a man, they're exceedingly proud. And proud men, I found, aren't inclined to make wise decisions.
The implication was clear. Soon their lives would depend upon the wise decisions of these men. The prince gestured to a tall galioth standing beneath the hanging rose and green of a tamarisk tree.
That's Prince Coithus Sobham, seventh son of King Eryit and leader of the Galioth contingent. The man he argues with is his nephew, Athgieri, Earl of Gainry. Coithus Sobham has quite a reputation in these parts. He commanded the army his father sent against the Nansurium several years ago. He managed several successes, or so I'm told, but was humiliated by Confis after the emperor made him exalt general. Perhaps no man living hates the Icuris as much as he, but he cares nothing for the Tusk or the latter prophet. Again, Proyas left the implications unspoken. The Galioth prince was a mercenary who would support them only where their ends coincided with his own. Kellis appraised the man's face, which was strong-jawed and barred handsome, beneath a shock of reddish-blonde hair.
Their eyes met. Sauban nodded in guarded courtesy.
A barely perceptible quickening of his heartbeat, a faint flush rising to his cheeks. Eyes vaguely narrowing, as though half-squinted against an unseen blow. He fears nothing more than the estimation of other men. Kellis nodded in return, his expression frank, guileless. Sauban had been raised, he realized, under the harsh gaze of another. A cruel father, perhaps, or mother. He would make a demonstration of his life, shame the eyes that measure.
Nothing impoverishes, Kellis said to Proyas, more than ambition.
Indeed, Proyas replied in approval, also nodding to the Galioth prince. That man there? The prince continued, gesturing to a thick-waisted Tidoni beyond the Galioth. Is Hoga Gothjalk, Earl of Agansinor, an elected leader of the contingent from Seta Don. Before I was born, my father was bested by him at the Battle of Man. He calls his limp Gothjalk's gift.
Proyas smiled, a devoted son who took much heart in his father's humor. According to rumor, Hoga Gothjalk is as pious in the temple as he's indomitable on the field. And again the implication, he's one of us. Unlike Sobham, the Earl of Agansinor was unaware of their momentary scrutiny. He was busy berating three younger men in what must have been his native tongue. His beard, a long pelt of iron gray, swung and shivered as he hollered. His broad nose flared, his eyes flashed beneath overgrown brows.
Those men he upbraids? Kellis asked.
His sons, three of them anyway. In Conria we call them the Hoga Brood. He scolds them for drinking too heavily. The Emperor, he says, wants them drunk. But far more than their drinking, Kellis knew, had incited the old Earl's fury. Something weary haunted his expression, something whose momentum had faltered over the course of a long and turbulent life. Hoga Gothjalk no longer felt anger, not truly, only varieties of sorrow. But for what reason? He's done something. He thinks himself damned. Yes, there it was. The hidden resolution,
like slack threads in the taut creases of his face around his eyes. He's come to die. Die cleansed. And that man, Proyas continued, daring to point, in the center of that group wearing masks, do you see him? Proyas had gestured to their extreme left, where far and away the largest party had gathered, the Palatine governors of High Anon. To a man they were dressed in spectacular gowns. Beneath their plaited wigs they wore masks of white porcelain across their eyes and cheeks. They looked like bearded statues. The one whose hair is wired like a fan across his back? Kellis asked. Proyas graced him with a sour smile. Indeed. That's none other than Kepharamuni himself, the king regent of High Anon, and lapdog of the Scarlet Spires. Do you see how he spurns all offers of food and drink? He fears the emperor will try to drug him. Why do they wear masks? The Anoni are a debauched people, Proyas replied, casting a wary glance at their immediate vicinity. A race of mummers. They're overly concerned with the subtleties of human intercourse. They regard a concealed face a potent weapon in all matters concerning Janann.
Janann, Nayur muttered, is a disease you all suffer.
Proyas smiled, amused by the relentlessness of the plainsman's contempt. Doubtless we do, but the Anoni suffer it mortally. Forgive me, Kellis said, but just what is Janann? Proyas shot him a puzzled look. I've never pondered it much before, he admitted. Biantis, I recall, defines it as the war of word and sentiment. But it's far more. The subtleties that guide the conduct between men, you might say. It's, he shrugged, simply something we do. Kellis nodded. They know so little of themselves, father. Troubled by the inadequacy of his reply, Proyas redirected their attention to a small group of men standing about the garden's pool, all wearing the same white tusk-emblazoned vestments over their tunics. There, the one with silver hair? That's Incieri Gotien, Grand Master of the Shrial Knights. He's a good man, the Shrier's own envoy. Mathenet has directed him to judge our suit against the Emperor. Gotien awaited the Emperor in silence, clutching in his hands a small ivory canister, a missive, Kellis assumed, from Mathenet himself. Though Gotien presented the look of self-assurance, Kellis saw instantly that he was anxious. The rapid pulse of his jugular beneath the dark skin of his neck, the flexing of tendons along the back of his hand, the taut pose of the musculature about his lips. He does not feel equal to his burden. But more than anxiety simmered beneath his expression. His eyes also betrayed a curious longing, one that Kellis had witnessed many times in many faces. He yearns to be moved, moved by someone more holy than he. A good man, Kellis repeated. I need only convince him I'm more holy. And that there, Proya said, nodding to his right, is Prince Skeelt of Thunieres, standing in the shadow of that giant, the one they call Yalgrota. Whether by design or otherwise, the small Thunieri contingent occupied the periphery of the gathered Inrithi lords. Of all the nobility gathered in the garden, they alone were geared for battle, wearing hauberks of black chain under sleeved surcoats embroidered with stylized animals. To a man, they sported wiry beards and long corn-silk hair. Skeelt's face was uniformly scarred, as though by pox, and he muttered somberly to hard-eyed Yalgrota, who hulked above him, glaring across heads at Nayur. Have you ever seen such a man? Proyas hissed, staring at the giant with frank admiration. Let's pray his interest in you is academic, Skilvendi. Nayur matched Yalgrota's gaze without blinking.
Yes, he said evenly, for his sake. A man is measured by more than his frame.
Proyas arched his brows, grinned sidelong at Kellis. You think, Kellis asked the Skilvendi, that he's not as long as he's tall? Proyas laughed aloud, but Nayur's ferocious eyes seized Kellis.
Play these fools if you must, Dunyane, but do not play me.
You're beginning, Proyas said,
to remind me of Zynemus, my prince, of the man he esteems above all others. An angry cry surfaced from the background bustle of voices.
Geirga fahierst! Geirga fahierst, Astamoya!
Gathjelk, once again chastising one of his sons, this time from across the garden. What are those pendants the Thunieri wear between their thighs? Kellis asked Proyas. They looked like shriveled apples. The shrunken heads of shrunk. They make fetishes of their enemies, and we can expect, his distaste soured into a grimace, that they'll sport human heads soon enough, once the Holy War begins its march. As I was about to say, the Thunieri are young to the Three Seas. They embraced the Thousand Temples and the Latter Prophet only in my grandfather's time, so they're zealous in the way of converted peoples. But interminable war with a Shrank has rendered them morbid, melancholy, deranged even. Scaled is no exception in this regard, as far as I can tell. The man can't speak a word of Shaik. He'll need to be managed, I imagine, but not taken seriously otherwise. There's a great game here, Kellis thought, and there's no place for those who don't know the rules. Nevertheless, he asked, Why's that? Because he's uncouth, an illiterate barbarian. The answer he expected, the one certain to alienate the Skilvendi. As though on cue, Naor snorted.
And just what, he asked scathingly, do you think the others say of me?
The prince shrugged. Much the same, I imagine. But that'll quickly change, Skilvendi. Proya stopped mid-reply, his attention stolen by the sudden hush that had fallen upon the Inrithi nobles. Three figures approached through the shade of the surrounding colonnades. Two men, Eothic guardsmen by the look of their armor and insignia, pulled a shambling third between them. The man was naked, emaciated, and freighted by heavy shackles about his neck, wrists, and ankles. From the scars that latticed his arms, it was obvious he was Skilvendi.
Cunning fiends, Proyas muttered under his breath.
The guardsmen yanked the man into sunlight. He wobbled drunkenly, heedless of his exposed phallus. He raised a piteous face to the warmth of the sun. His eyes had been gouged out. Who is he? Kellis asked. Naor spat, watched the guardsmen chain the man to the base of the emperor's bench.
Zunarit, he said after a moment. Our king of tribes at the Battle of Gaiuth.
A token of Skilvendi weakness, no doubt, Proya said tightly. Of Naor Uzgiotha's weakness, evidence in what will be your trial.
You will sit here in posture, the pragma said,
neither stern nor gentle,
and repeat this proposition. The Logos is without beginning or end. You will repeat this without cessation until you are directed otherwise. Do you understand?
Yes, pragma, Kellis replied. He lowered himself onto a small mat of woven reeds in the center of the shrine. The pragma sat opposite him on a similar mat, his back to the sunlit poplars and the scowling precipices of the mountains beyond.
Begin,
the pragma said, becoming motionless. The Logos is without beginning or end. The Logos is without beginning or end. The Logos is without... At first he puzzled over the ease of the exercise, but the words quickly lost their meaning and became a repetitive string of unfamiliar sounds, more a pasty exercise of tongue, teeth, and lips than speaking.
Cease saying this aloud, the pragma said. Speak it only within.
The Logos is without beginning or end. The Logos is without beginning or end. The Logos is without... This was far different and, as he quickly discovered, far more difficult. Speaking the proposition aloud had braced the repetition somehow, as though propping thought against his organs of speech. Now it stood alone, suspended in the nowhere of his soul, repeated and repeated and repeated, contrary to all the habits of inference and drifting association. The Logos is without beginning or end. The Logos is without beginning or end. The Logos is without... The first thing he noted was the curious slackness of his face, as though the exercise had somehow severed the links, shackling expression to passion.
His body grew very still, far more so than he'd ever experienced before. At the same time, however, curious waves of tension assailed him from within, as though something deep balked, refusing inner breath to his inner voice, and the repetition was muted to a whisper, became a thin thread undulating through violent eddies of inarticulate, unformed thought. The Logos is without beginning or end. The Logos is without beginning or end. The Logos is without beginning or end. The Logos is without... The sun waxed across the disheveled mountainsides, mottling his periphery with a contrast of dark plummets and bright, bald faces. Kellis found himself at war. Inchoate urges reared from nothingness, demanding thought. Unuttered voices untwined from darkness, demanding thought. Hissing images railed, pleaded, threatened, all demanding thought. And through it all, the Logos is without beginning or end. The Logos is without beginning or end. The Logos is without... Long afterward, he would realize this exercise had demarcated his soul. The incessant repetition of the pragma's proposition had pitted him against himself, had shown him the extent to which he was other to himself. For the first time, he could truly see the darkness that had preceded him. And he knew that before this day, he had never truly been awake. When the sun at last set, the pragma broke his fast of silence.
You have completed your first day, young Kellis, and now you will continue through the night. When the dawn sun broaches the eastern glacier, you will cease repeating the last word of the proposition, but otherwise continue. Each time the sun breaks from the glacier, you will cease repeating the last word. Do you understand?
Yes, Pragma.
Word spoken, it seemed, by someone else. Then continue. As darkness entombed the shrine, the struggle intensified. By turns, his body became remote to the point of giddiness and near to the point of suffocation. One moment he would be an apparition, an accident of coiling smoke, so insubstantial it seemed the night breeze might smear him into nothingness. In another, he would be a bundle of cramped flesh, every sensation sharpened until even the night chill chattered like knives across his skin. And the proposition became something drunken, something that stumbled and staggered through a nightmarish chorus of agitations, distractions, and frenzied passions. They howled within him, like something dying. Then the sun broke from the glacier, and he was dumbstruck by its beauty. Smoldering orange cresting cold plains of shining snow and ice. And for a heartbeat, the proposition escaped him, and he thought only of the way the glacier reared, curved like the back of a beautiful woman. The pragma leapt forward and struck him, his face a rictus of counterfeit rage.
Repeat the proposition!
He screamed.
For Kellis, each of the great names represented a question, a juncture of innumerable permutations. In their faces, he saw fragments of other faces surfacing, as though all men were but moments of one man. An instant of Lueth passing like a squall through Athgieri's scowl as he argued with Sauban. A glimpse of Serwe in the way Gothjalk looked upon his youngest son. The same passions, but each cast in a drastically different balance. Any one of these people, he concluded, might be as easily possessed as Lueth had been, despite their fierce pride. But in their sum, they were incalculable. They were a labyrinth, a thousand, thousand halls, and he had to pass through them. He had to own them. What if this holy war exceeds my abilities? What then, father?
Do you feast, Dunyane? Nayor asked in bitter Skilvendi. Grow fat on faces?
Proyas had left them to confer with Gotian, and for the moment the two of them were alone.
We share the same mission, Skilvendi.
So far, events had exceeded his most optimistic forecasts. His claim to royal blood had secured him, almost effortlessly, a position among the Enrithi ruling castes.
Not only had Proya supplied him with the necessities of his princely rank, he had accorded him a place of honor at his council fire. So long as one possessed the bearing of a prince, Kellis discovered, one was treated as a prince. Acting became being. His other claim, however, his claim to have dreamt of Shaima and the Holy War, had secured him a far different position, one more fraught with peril and possibility. Some openly scoffed at the claim. Others, like Proyas and Akamian, viewed it as a possible warning, like the first flush of disease. Many, searching for whatever scrap of divine sanction they could find, simply accepted it. But all of them conceded Kellis the same position. For the peoples of the Three Seas, dreams, no matter how trivial, were a serious matter. Dreams were not, as the Dunyane had thought before Moengus's summons, mere rehearsals, ways for the soul to train itself for different eventualities. Dreams were the portal, the place where the outside infiltrated the world, where what transcended men, be it the future, the distant, the demonic, or the divine, found imperfect expression in the here and now. But it was not enough to simply assert that one had dreamed. If dreams were powerful, they were also cheap. Everyone dreamed. After patiently listening to descriptions of his visions, Proyas had explained to Kellis that literally thousands claimed to dream of the Holy War, some of its triumph, others of its destruction. One could not walk 10 yards along the Phaeus, he said, without seeing some hermit screech and gesticulate about his dreams. Why, he asked with characteristic honesty, should I regard your dreams as any different? Dreams were a serious matter, and serious matters demanded hard questions. Perhaps you shouldn't, Kellis had replied. I'm not sure I do. And it was this, his reluctance to believe his own prophetic claims, that had secured his perilous position. When Anonymous in Rethi, having heard rumors of him, fell to their knees before him, he would be cross, the way a compassionate father would be cross. When they begged to be touched, as though grace could be communicated across skin, he would touch them, but only to raise them up, to chide them for abasing themselves before another. By claiming to be less than what he seemed to be, he moved men, even learned men such as Proyas and Akamian, to hope or fear that he might be more. He would never utter it, never claim it, but he would manufacture the circumstances that would make it seem true. Then all those who counted themselves secret watchers, all those who breathlessly asked, "Who is this man?" would be gratified. Like never before, he would be their insight. They would be unable to doubt him then. To doubt him would be to think their own insights empty. To disown him would be to disown themselves. Kellis would step onto conditioned ground. So many permutations, but I see the path, Father. Laughter pealed across the garden. Some young Galioth thane, weary of standing, had thought the Emperor's stool a good place to rest. He sat for several moments, oblivious to the surrounding mirth, alternately studying the glazed pork jumyan he'd pilfered from a slave, and the naked man chained at his feet. When he finally realized that everyone laughed at him, he decided he rather liked the attention, and began striking a series of mock imperial poses. The men of the Tusk roared. Eventually, Sauban collected the youth and led him back to his applauding kinsmen. Moments afterward, a file of imperial apparati, all dressed in the voluminous robes of their station, announced the arrival of the Emperor. With Confis at his side, Icuri Zarius III appeared just as the hilarity subsided, his expression a mixture of benevolence and distaste. He sat upon his stool and rekindled his guest's mirth when he adopted the very pose, his left palm facing up upon his lap, his right curled down before him, that the young Galioth had aped just moments before. Kellis watched his face grow pale with rage as one of his eunuchs explained the laughter. There was murder in his eyes when he dismissed the man, and he struggled with his posture for a moment. To be premeditated, he knew, was the most galling of insults. In this way, even an emperor might be made a slave, though Kellis realized he did not know why. Finally, Zariah settled on the Norserai posture, hands braced on his knees. Several long moments of silence passed as he mastered his rage. During this time, Kellis studied the faces of the imperial retinue, the seamless arrogance of the emperor's nephew, Confis, the panic of the slaves, so attuned to their master's tumultuous passions, the tight-lipped disapproval of the imperial councils arrayed in a semicircle behind their emperor, their center, and a different face among the councils, a troubling face. It was the subtlest of incongruities, a vague wrongness that drew his attention at first. An old man, dressed in fine charcoal silk robes, a man obviously deferred to and respected by the others. One of his companions leaned to him and muttered something inaudible through the rumble of voices, but Kellis could see his lips. Skaos, the council's name. Drawing a deep breath, Kellis allowed the momentum of his own thought to slow and still. Who he was in his everyday concourse with other men ceased to exist, peeled away like petals in bloom. The tempo of events slowed. He became a place, a blank field for a single figure, the weathered landscape of an old man's face. No perceptible blush reflex, disconnect between heart rate and apparent expression. But the drone of surrounding voices trailed into silence, and he withdrew. Reassembled. The Emperor was about to speak, words that could seal the fate of the Holy War. 5 heartbeats had passed. What could this mean? A single, indecipherable face among a welter of transparent expressions. Skaos, are you my father's work? The Logos is without beginning or... The Logos is without... For a moment, he could taste blood on his split lips, but the sensation was slowly rinsed away by the ruthless litany. The inner cacophony faltered, trailed into death-like silence. His body became an utter stranger, a disposable frame. And the movement of time itself, the pace of the before and after, transformed. The shadows of the shrine's pillars swept across the bare floor. Sunlight fell upon, then flickered from his face. He wet and soiled himself, but there was no discomfort, no smell. And when the old pragma stood and poured water across his lips, he was merely a smooth rock embedded in moss and gravel beneath the waterfall. The sun skirted the pillars before him, then lowered behind him, drawing his shadow across the lap of the pragma, and then amid the burnished trees, where it congregated with its kinsmen and bloated into night. Again and again, he witnessed the sun rise and topple, the momentary respite of night, and with each dawning, the proposition was further dismembered. While the world quickened, the movement of his soul slowed, until he whispered only, "The Logos. The Logos. The Logos." He was a hollow filled by echoes bereft of any authoring voice, each phrase a flawless reiteration of the preceding. He was a wayfarer through the abysmal gallery of mirror set against mirror, his every step as illusory as the last. Only sun and night marked his passage, and only then, by narrowing the gap between mirrors to the impossible place where vanishing point threatened to kiss vanishing point, to the place where the soul fell utterly still. When the sun reared yet again, his thoughts receded to a single word. The. And it seemed at once an absurd stutter and the most profound of thoughts, as though only in the absence of Logos could it settle into the rhythm of his heart muscling through moment after moment. Thought thinned and daylight swept through, over and behind the shrine, until night pierced the shroud of the sky, until the heavens revolved like an infinite chariot wheel.
The.
A moving soul chained to the brink, to the exquisite moment before something, anything. The tree, the heart, the everything transformed into nothing by repetition, by the endless accumulation of the same refusal to name. A corona of gold across the high slopes of the glacier, and then nothing. No thought.
The Empire welcomes you,
Zarius announced, his voice straining to be mild. He drew his gaze across the great names of the men of the Tusk, lingering for a moment on the Skilvendi at Kellis's side. He smiled.
Ah, yes, he said. Our most extraordinary addition, the Skilvendi. They tell me that you're a chieftain of the Otomot. Is this so, Skilvendi?
It is so, Nayor answered.
The Emperor measured this reply. He was in no mood, Kellis could see, for the niceties of Janann.
I, too, have a Skilvendi, he said. He bared his forearm from intricate sleeves and grasped the chain between his feet. He yanked it savagely, and the huddled Zunarit raised his blinded, broken face to the onlookers. His naked body was skeletal, malnourished, and his limbs seemed to hang from different hinges, hinges that all turned in, away from the world. The long strips of swazand along his arms now seemed a measure more of the bones beneath than of his bloody past. Tell me,
the Emperor said, finding comfort in this petty brutality.
Of what tribe is this one?
Nayur seemed unaffected.
This one was of the Akunahor.
Was, you say? He's dead to you, I suppose.
No, not dead. He is nothing to me.
The Emperor smiled as though warming to a small mystery, a suitable distraction from weightier matters. But Kellis could see the machinations beneath, the confidence that he would show this savage to be an ignorant fool, the need.
Because we've broken him, hmm?
The Emperor pressed.
Broken whom?
Ikuri Zarius paused.
This dog here, Zunarit, king of tribes, your king.
Nayor shrugged, as though puzzled by a child's petty caprice.
You have broken nothing.
There was some laughter at this. The Emperor soured. Kellis could see an appreciation of Nayor's intellect stumble to the forefront of his thoughts. There was reassessment, a revision of strategies. He's accustomed, Kellis thought, to recovering from blunders.
Yes, Zarius said. To break one man is to break nothing, I suppose. It's too easy to break a man, but to break a people, surely this is something, no?
The Imperial expression became jubilant when Nayor failed to reply. The Emperor continued.
My nephew here, Confis, has broken a people. Perhaps you've heard of them. The people of war?
Again, Nayor refused to answer. His look, however, was murderous.
Your people, Skilvendi. Broken at Kaiuth. Were you at Kaiuth, I wonder?
I was at Kaiuth.
Nayor grated.
Were you broken?
Silence.
Were you broken?
All eyes were now on the Skilvendi.
I was.
He searched for the proper Shaik term.
Schooled at Kaiuth.
Were you now? The Emperor cried. I should imagine. Confis is a most demanding instructor. So tell me. What lesson did you learn?
Confis was my lesson.
Confis?
The Emperor repeated.
You must forgive me, Skilvendi, but I'm puzzled.
Nayor continued, his tone deliberate.
At Kaiuth, I learned what Confis has learned. He is a general bred on many battlefields. From the Galeoth, he learned the effectiveness of disciplined pike formations against mounted charges. From the Kianin, He learned the effectiveness of channeling his opponent, of the false flight, and of the wisdom of hoarding his horsemen in reserve. And from the Skilvendi, he learned the importance of the Gobokzoi, the moment that one must read his enemy from afar and strike at the instant of their unbalance. At Cayuth, I learned, he continued, turning his hard eyes upon Confis, that war is intellect.
The shock was plain on the imperial nephew's face, and Kellis wondered at the force of these words. But too much happened for him to focus on this problem. The air was taut with this contest of emperor and barbarian. Now it was the emperor's turn to remain silent. Kellis understood the stakes of this exchange. The emperor needed to show the incompetence of the Skilvendi. Sarius had made his indenture the price of Icuri Confis. Like any merchant, Sarius could justify this price only by maligning the wares of his competitors.
Enough of this prattle, Coithas Sobin cried. The great names have heard enough, but it is not for the great names to decide, the emperor snapped. Nor is it for Icuri Sarius to decide,
Proyas added, his eyes bright with zeal. Grizzled Gothiel cried,
Gothian, what says the Shrier? What says Maisonette of our Emperor's indenture?
But it's too soon,
the Emperor sputtered.
We haven't sounded this man, this heathen.
But others clamored,
Gothian!
Then what say you, Gothian?
The Emperor cried.
Would you have a heathen lead you against the heathen? Would you be punished as the vulgar holy war was punished on the plains of Mengeda? How many dead? How many enslaved by Kalmamunus's rash humor? The great names lead,
Proya shouted.
The Skilvendi will be our advisor. An outrage still,
the emperor roared.
An army with 10 generals? When you founder, and you will, for you know not the cunning of the Kianine, then to whom will you turn, a Skilvendi? In your moment of crisis, of all the absurdities, it will be a heathen's holy war then. Sweet Sejanus, this man's a Skilvendi,
he cried plaintively, as though to a loved one gone mad.
Does this mean nothing to you fools? He is a blight upon the very earth. His very name is blasphemy, an abomination before the god.
You'd speak of outrage to us?
Proyas cried in reply.
You'd school in piety those who'd sacrifice their very lives for the tusk? What of your iniquities, Icuri? What of you, who'd make a tool of the holy war?
I would preserve the holy war, Proyas. Save the god's instrument from your ignorance.
But we're ignorant no longer, Icuri,
Sobin answered.
You've heard the Skilvendi speak. We've heard him speak.
But this man would sell you. He's Skilvendi. Haven't you heard me?
How could we not? Sobin spat. You screech louder than my wife.
Rumbling laughter.
My uncle speaks the truth. Confis called out, and a hush fell across the noblemen.
The great Confis had finally spoken. He would be the more sober voice.
You know nothing of the Skilvendi, he continued matter-of-factly. They're not heathens like the Fainim. Their wickedness isn't one of distortion, of twisting the true faith into an abomination. They're a people without gods.
Confis strode down to the king of tribes at the emperor's feet, yanked the blinded face back for all to see. He grabbed one of the emaciated arms.
They call these scars swazond, he said, as though a patient tutor. A word that means dyings. To us, they are little more than savage trophies, not unlike the shrunken shrunk heads that the Thunieri stitch onto their shields. But they're far more to the Skilvendi. Those dyings are their only purpose. The very meaning of their lives is written into those scars. Our dyings. Do you understand this?
He looked into the faces of the assembled Enrithi, was satisfied by the apprehension he saw there. It was one thing to admit a heathen into their midst. It was quite another to have the details of his wickedness enumerated.
What the savage said earlier is not true, Confis resumed. This man isn't nothing. He's far, far more.
He's a token of their humiliation, the humiliation of the Skilvendi.
He stared hard at Zunarit's impassive face, the sunken, weeping sockets. Then he looked to Nayor, where he stood at Proyas's side.
Look at him, he said casually. Look at the one you'd make your general. Don't you think he thirsts for vengeance? Don't you think that even now he struggles to beat down the fury in his heart? Are you so naive as to believe that he doesn't plot our destruction? That his soul does not twist as men's souls do with scenarios, with images? His vengeance glutted and our ruin complete?
Confis looked to Proyas.
Ask him, Proyas. Ask him what moves his soul.
There was a pause filled by the ambient murmur of muttering noblemen. Kellis turned to the enigmatic face hovering above the Emperor. As a child, he'd seen expressions in the same manner as world-born men, as something understood without understanding. But now he could see the joists beneath the planks of a man's expression, and because of this, he could calculate, with terrifying exactitude, the distribution of forces down to a man's foundation. But the scales baffled him. Where he saw through others, he saw only the mimicry of depth in the old man's face. The nuanced musculature that produced his expression was unrecognizable, as though moored to different bones. This man had not been trained in the manner of the Dunyane. Rather, his face was not a face. Moments passed. Incongruities accumulated, were classified, cobbled into hypothetical alternatives. Limbs, slender limbs folded and pressed into the simulacrum of a face. Kellis blinked, and his senses leapt back into their proper proportion. How was this possible? Sorcery? If so, it possessed nothing of the strange torsion he'd experienced with the non-man he'd battled so long ago. Sorcery, Kellis had realized, was inexplicably grotesque, like the scribblings of a child across a work of art, though he did not know why. All he knew was that he could distinguish sorcery from the world and sorcerers from common men. This was among the many mysteries that had motivated his study of Drusus Acamian. This face, he was relatively certain, had nothing to do with sorcery. But then how? What is this man? Abruptly, Skaeus's eyes flashed to his own, the rutted brow clenched in a false frown. Kellis nodded in the amicable and embarrassed way of one caught staring at another. But in his periphery, he glimpsed the Emperor looking toward him in alarm, then whirling to scrutinize his counsel. Icuris Arias had not known this face differed, Kellis realized. None of them knew. The study deepens, Father. Always it deepens.
As a youth, Proyas was saying, I was tutored by a mandate schoolman, Confis. He'd say you're rather optimistic about the Skilvendi.
Several laughed openly at this, relieved.
Mandate stories, Confis said evenly, are worthless.
Perhaps, Proyas replied,
but of a par with Nansur stories.
But that's not the question, Proyas,
old Gothyelk said, his accent so thick that his sheikh was barely comprehensible.
The question is, how can we trust this heathen?
Proyas turned to the Skilvendi at his side, suddenly hesitant.
Then what of it, Nayor?
He asked. Throughout the exchange, Nayor had remained silent, doing little to conceal his contempt. Now he spat in Confis's direction. No thought. The boy extinguished. Only a place. This place. Motionless, the pragma sat facing him, the bare soles of his feet flat against each other, his dark frock scored by the shadows of deep folds, his eyes as empty as the child they watched. A place without breath or sound. A place of sight alone. A place without, before, or after. Almost. For the first lances of sunlight careered over the glacier, as ponderous as great tree limbs in the wind. Shadows hardened and light gleamed across the pragma's ancient skull. The old man's left hand forsook his right sleeve, bearing a watery knife, and like a rope in water, his arm pitched outward, fingertips trailing across the blade as the knife swung languidly into the air, the sun skating and the dark shrine plunging across its mirror back, and the place where Kellis had once existed extended an open hand, the blonde hairs like luminous filaments against tanned skin, and grasped the knife from stunned space. The slap of pommel against palm triggered the collapse of place into little boy, the pale stench of his body, breath, sound, and lurching thoughts. I have been legion. In his periphery, he could see the spike of the sun ease from the mountain. He felt drunk with exhaustion. In the recoil of his trance, it seemed all he could hear were the twigs arching and bobbing in the wind, pulled by leaves like a million sails no bigger than his hand, caws everywhere, but amid countless minute happenings, diffuse, useless. Now I understand.
You would sound me, Nayor said at length. Make clear the riddle of the Skilvendi heart. But you use your own hearts to map mine. You see a man abased before you, Zunarit, a man bound to me by kinship of blood. What an offense this must be, you say. His heart must cry for vengeance. And you say this because your heart would so cry. But my heart is not your heart. This is why it is a riddle to you. Zunarit is not a name of shame to the people. It is not even a name. He who does not ride among us is not us. He is other. But you, who mistake your heart for mine, who see only two Skilvendi, one broken, one erect, think he must still belong to me. You think his degradation is my own and that I would avenge this. Confis would have you think this. Why else would Zunarit be among us? What better way to discredit the strong man than by making a broken man his double? Perhaps it is the Nansur heart that should be sounded.
But our heart is in Rethi, Confis said scathingly. It's already known.
Yes, it is, Sobbin said fiercely. It would seize the holy war from the god and make it its own.
No,
Confis spat.
My heart would save the holy war for the god. Save it from this abominable dog, and save you from your folly. The Skilvendi are anathema,
as are the Scarlet Spires, Sobbin retorted, advancing toward Confis.
Would you have us cast them out as well?
That's different,
Confis snapped. The men of the Tusk need the Scarlet Spires. Without them, the Kishorum would destroy us. Sobbin paused a few paces away from the High General. He looked lean, wolfish.
The Enrithi need this Skilvendi as well. This is what you tell us, Confis. We must be saved from our own folly on the field of battle.
Kalmamunas and your kinsmen, Thar Shilka, have told you that, fool, with their death on the plains of Mengeda.
Kalmamunas, Sobbin spat. Thar Shilka, rabble marching with rabble.
Tell me, Confis, Proyas asked. Did you not know that Kalmamunas was doomed beforehand? If so, why did the Emperor provision him?
None of this is to the point,
Confis cried. He lies, Kellis realized. They knew the vulgar holy war would be destroyed. They wanted it to be destroyed. Suddenly, Kellis understood that the outcome of this debate was in fact paramount to his mission. The Icuris had sacrificed an entire host in order to strengthen their claim over the Holy War. What further disaster would they manufacture once it became an inconvenience?
The question, Confis ardently continued, is whether you can trust a Skilvendi to lead you against the Kianine.
But that isn't the question, Proyas countered. The question is whether we can trust a Skilvendi over you.
But how could this even be an issue?
Confis implored.
Trust a Skilvendi over me?
He laughed harshly.
This is madness!
Your madness, Confis, Sobbin grated. And your uncle's. If it weren't for your fucking forecasts of doom and your thrice-damned indenture, none of this would be an issue.
But it's our land you would seize!
The blood of our ancestors smeared across every plain, every hillock, and you would begrudge us our claim?
It's the god's land, Ikuri, Proyar said cuttingly. The very land of the latter prophet. Or would you put the pathetic annals of Nansor before the tractate, before our lord, Inri Sejanos?
Confress remained silent for a moment, gauging these words. One did not, Kellis realized, lightly enter a contest of piety with Nerse Proyas.
And who are you, Proyas, to ask this question?
Confess returned, rallying his earlier calm.
Hmm? You who would put a heathen, a Skilvendi, no less, before Sejanus?
We are all instruments of the gods, Ikuri. Even a heathen, a Skilvendi, no less, can be an instrument, if such is the god's will.
Would we guess at god's will then, eh, Proyas?
That, Ikuri, is Mathanet's task.
Proyas turned to Gotian, who had been watching them keenly all this time.
What does Mathanet say, Gotian? Tell us, what says the Shrier?
The Grand Master's hands were clenched about the ivory canister. He held the answer everyone knew within his straining hands. His expression was hesitant.
He remains undecided. He despises the Emperor, distrusts him, but he fears that Proyas's solution is too radical.
Very soon, Kellis realized, he would be forced to intercede.
I would ask the Skilvendi, Gotian said, clearing his voice, why he has come.
Nayor looked hard at the Shrial Knight, at the tusk embroidered in gold across his white vestment.
The words are in you, Skilvendi. Speak them.
I have come, Nayor said at length, for the promise of war. But this is something that Skilvendi simply don't do.
Gotian responded, his suspicion tempered by hope.
There are no Skilvendi mercenaries, at least none I've ever heard of.
I do not sell myself, if that is what you mean. The people do not sell anything. What we need, we seize.
Yes, he would seize us,
Confess interjected.
Let the man speak,
Gothiel cried, his patience waning.
After Caiuth,
Nayor continued.
The Utumot were undone. The steppe is not how you think. The people war always, if not against the Srank, Nansur, or Kianin, then against themselves. Our pastures were overrun by our competitors of old. Our herds slaughtered. Our camps burned. I became a chieftain of nothing.
Nayor looked over their intent faces. Stories, if fitting, Kellis had learned, commanded respect.
From this man,
he continued, gesturing to Kellis,
I learned that outlanders could have honor. As a slave, he fought at our side against the Kuoti. Through him, through his god-sent dreams, I learned of your war. I was without my tribe, so I accepted his wager.
Many eyes, Kellis noted, were now fixed upon him. Should he seize this moment? Or allow the Skilvendi to continue?
Wager?
Gotian asked, both puzzled and slightly awed.
That this war would be unlike any other. That it would be a revelation.
I see,
Gotian replied, his eyes suddenly bright with faith remembered.
Do you?
Nayor asked.
I do not think so. I remain a Skilvendi.
The plainsman looked to Proyas, then swept his eyes across the illustrious assembly.
Do not mistake me, Inriti. In this much, Confis is right. You are all staggering drunks to me. Boys who would play at war when you should kennel with your mothers. You know nothing of war. War is dark, black as pitch. It is not a god. It does not laugh or weep. It rewards neither skill nor daring. It is not a trial of souls, not a measure of wills. Even less, it is a tool, a means to some womanish end. It is merely the place where the iron bones of the earth meet the hollow bones of men and break them. You have offered me war, and I have accepted. Nothing more. I will not regret your losses. I will not bow my head before your funeral pyres. I will not rejoice at your triumph. But I have taken the wager. I will suffer with you. I will put Phaenum to the sword and drive their wives and children to the slaughter. And when I sleep, I will dream of their lamentations and be glad of heart.
There was a moment of stunned silence. Then Gathiok, the old Earl of Agansanor, said,
I've ridden on many campaigns. My bones are old, but they're my bones still, not the fire's. And I've learned to trust the man who hates openly and to fear only those who hate in secret. I'm satisfied with this man's answer, though I like it little.
He turned to Confis, his eyes narrow with distrust.
It's a sad thing when a heathen schools us in honesty.
Slowly this assent was echoed by others.
There's wisdom in the heathen's words,
Sobbin shouted over the rumble.
We do well to listen.
But Gotien remained troubled. Unlike the others, he was Nansur, and Kallus could see that he shared many of the misapprehensions of the Emperor and the Exalt General. News of Skilvendi atrocities were a daily fact of life for the Nansur. Without warning, the Grand Master sought his eyes through the crowd. Kallus could see the catastrophic scenarios wheel through the man's soul. The Holy War, ruined, and all because of a decision made by him in the name of Mathenet.
I have dreamed of this war,
Kallus said suddenly. As the Enrithi yielded to his as yet unheard voice, he gathered them in his watery gaze.
I wouldn't pretend to tell you the meaning of those dreams, for I don't know.
He stood within the hallow circle of their god, he had said, but he possessed no presumption. He doubted the way upright men doubted, and would brook no pretense in the search for truth.
But I do know this. The decision before you is clear.
A declaration of certainty, fortified by the admission of uncertainty that prefaced it. Those few things I do know, he had said. I know.
Two men have asked you to make a concession. Prince Nersay Proyas has asked that you accept the stewardship of a Skilvendi heathen, while Icuri Zorias has asked that you bind yourselves to the interests of the Empire. The question is simple. Which concession is greater?
The demonstration of wisdom and insight through clarification. Their recognition of this would cement their respect, prepare them for further recognitions, and convince them that his voice belonged to reason and not to his own mercenary concerns.
On the one hand, we have an emperor who willingly provisioned the vulgar holy war, even though he knew it was almost certain to be destroyed. On the other hand, we have a chieftain who has spent the entirety of his life plundering and murdering the faithful.
He paused, smiling ruefully.
In my homeland, we call this a dilemma.
Warm laughter rumbled through the garden. Only Zorias and Confis did not smile. Kallus had circumvented the prestige of the Exalt General by fastening upon the Emperor, and he had depicted the problem of the Emperor's credibility as equal to that of the Skilvendi's, as only a just and equitable man would do. He had then sealed this equation with gentle wit, further securing their esteem and blurring comedic insight into the insight of truth.
Now, I can vouch for the honor of Naor Uskiotha, but then who would vouch for me? So let's assume that both men, emperor and chieftain, are equally untrustworthy. Given this, the answer lies in something you already know. We undertake the God's work. But it's dark and bloody work, nonetheless. There is no fiercer labor than war.
He studied their faces, glancing at each as though he stood with him alone. They stood upon the brink, he could see, on the cusp of the conclusion reason itself had compelled, even Zorias.
Whether we accept the stewardship of the emperor or the chieftain, he continued, we concede the same trust, and we concede the same labor.
Kallus paused, looked to Gotien. He could see the inferences move of their own volition through the man's soul.
But with the Emperor,
Gotian said, nodding slowly.
We concede the wages of our labor as well.
A murmur of profound agreement passed through the men of the Tusk.
What say you, Grandmaster? Prince Sobbin called. Is the Shrier satisfied?
But this is more nonsense,
Icuri Confis cried.
How could the Emperor of an Inrithi nation be as untrustworthy as a heathen savage?
The Exalt General had immediately seized upon the hinge of Kellis's argument, but his protest was too late. Without speaking, Gotian opened the canister, revealing two small scrolls within. He hesitated, his stern face pale. He held the future of the Three Seas in his palms, and he knew it. Gingerly, as though he handled some holy relic, he opened the scroll with a black wax seal. Turning to the silent emperor, the Grand Master of the Shrial Knights began reading, his voice resonant like a priest's.
Icuri Zorias III, Emperor of Nansur, by authority of the Tusk and the Tractate, and according to the ancient constitution of temple and state, you are ordered to provision the instrument of our great...
The roar of the assembly reverberated through the emperor's garden. Gotian's voice rumbled on about Inri Sejanus, about faith, about misplaced intentions, but already the joyous men of the Tusk had begun abandoning the garden, so eager were they to prepare for the march. Confis stood dumbstruck on the step below the emperor's stool, glaring at the Skilvendi king of tribes at his feet. Nearby, Proyas accepted the congratulations of his peers with dignified words and jubilant eyes. But Kellis studied the emperor through the flurry of figures. He was spitting orders to one of his resplendent guards, orders that, Kellis knew, had nothing to do with the Holy War.
Take Skaeus, his lips hissed, and then summon the others. The old wretch hides some treason.
Kellis watched the Eothic guardsman motion to his comrades, then close on the faceless council. They led him roughly away. What would they discover? There had been two contests in the emperor's garden. The handsome face of Icuri Zorias III then turned to him, as terrified as it was enraged.
He thinks I'm party to his council's treachery. He wishes to seize me, but can think of no pretext.
Kellis turned to Nayur, who stood stoically, studying the naked form of his kinsman chained beneath the emperor's feet.
We must leave quickly, Kellis said. There has been too much truth here.